That's international DJ, composer, and music producer Andrea Benigni, better known as Mop Mop, and his band, the Mop Mop Combo, with their unusual blending of acoustic and electronic music. This tune is called Kamakumba. It's from Mop Mop's 2013 album, Isle of Magic. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and I've got some explaining to do. I live in a very nice little town, But its infrastructure is being overhauled, and it's going to take some time before they've finished with everything, but they're working on it. One of the things that happens here is that when we have an unusually heavy period of thunderstorms and rain, things tend to go crazy, as they did yesterday. If you were listening yesterday toward the end of the program, unfortunately, during the talk that we were enjoying from David from Brooklyn, it just went out. We had a power outage, and it took some time before they got things together. But today, it's not, the weather is not the same, although it is raining, but slightly, and we do not have thunderstorms today. So we're back to even keel. It's unusual to have to adjust to this kind of stuff. You know, you come from big time city, New York, and here everybody learns to watch the weather, because it is likely to cramp your style. So we got through yesterday, and we're okay today. The much-anticipated report by Justice Department Inspector General Michael Horowitz on Justice Department and FBI investigations into how Hillary Clinton handled classified information when she was Secretary of State in the Obama administration is to be released today. The report would have been the subject of our program today, but it won't be released until 3 p.m. And of course, that blows any opportunity to peruse the report and to in turn report to you. So what we're going to do today is flip the script a bit. Today will be Free Your Mind Thursday, if you will, so that we can have enough time to digest some portions of this report as they relate to subject matter that we had been discussing for more than 2 years on this program. There's reason to believe that the report will contain pertinent information that would give us a clue as to where this probe is headed. So we'll do Free Your Mind Thursday today, and tomorrow we will discuss this report, which is more than 500 pages. So it's a lot of work, a lot of reading, a lot of deciphering, and we shouldn't kid ourselves. It's only going to be the opening. It's not going to be the full exploration of the fine points of the report that will have to be taken in kind of dribs and drabs. But for our purposes, since we've been reporting on the Clintons and the Clinton Foundation and Hillary Clinton and her emails and so forth, we will tackle that first. But nothing is happening before three, so there's no point in hanging in here to pretend that we know what's in the report. We won't see that until 3 o'clock. And so it makes sense to flick. With your permission, we'll take Free Your Mind Friday, move it up to Thursday today, because it's really about expressing opinions. And we can do that on any day, although we have stuck to our Friday schedule. So we'll use today as Free Your Mind Thursday. Same principle, same concept of speaking your mind on the issues of the day, sharing opinions and ideas in this open forum. And then tomorrow we will be able to use that time to discuss some of the most important aspects, for us anyway, of this report. All right, so 888-874-4888 is the number to call. I apologize to you. I certainly do, David from Brooklyn. I did not, it just went. And there was no way, I could not find a way to connect with the studio because nothing was going through for quite a while. And it took a bit of time before things came back to normal. Life, we just have to go roll with the punches. 888-874-4888 is the number to call. We have been dealing with some very interesting stories in the light of Trump's visit with the G7 nations in Quebec, and following that with another doozy of a meeting in Singapore with Chairman Kim Jong-un. But we'll see what you're talking about. We'll see what is of interest to you when you call 888-874-4888. Okay, Ma'at, you're on the air. You're the first one in.
Yes, hi. The line is a little scratchy. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, good. And I'm probably a little incoherent here because I've been up a long time, but I am catching your program today. Well, I don't know if people remember Machiavelli. I think I read it in high school. And he said something along the lines of sometimes you want to do a wise thing to simulate madness and as a strategy, right? The problem is Donald Trump is really a madman. I mean, I don't think it's any simulation out there. He has us in the 24-hour cycle deliberately, so he's always looking to break something so that the news can be about him. The problem is real news, and I'm talking about CNN and MSNBC, they do a lot of good coverage on the Russian connections, which are huge, and now it's also the UAE and what's that other place? There's another Middle Eastern place. I'm blanking on it because I'm very tired now that met with George Nader and cohorts. But the problem is when Baltimore went down, I still have to get on the internet and look at that news because there was a trial, Eutrice. Did you follow any of that? In Baltimore, where eight police got convicted, one that was supposed to provide important testimony the day before, he was shot in the head in an alley, you know, and they're debating whether it was murder or suicide. So, you know, the point I guess I'm making is that there's so much news. The fact that five or six states have done resolutions to abolish the Electoral College, right? Because we like to think we have one person, one vote, right? Not the case. And it only takes 11, but nobody's talking about that, you know, because that would be some break, some stopgap. But I want to hear, especially the way you cover police matters, I want to hear about what happened in Baltimore. Have you followed that at all?
No, except for, you know, the reports that were put in general circulation, but there is more.
Let's talk
I have
about
been
that.
Reaching out to sources here in New York City, police sources, who are in touch with what's going on, and I don't know that I don't know what to make of this, but I do know that it's unusual, and I do know that Baltimore, the city of Baltimore, has a very suspect history when it comes to things like this, so we can't really just take reports for granted. So
and let me just capitalize. Can I just briefly capitalize? In fact, there's a report that you can find on the internet. I heard on NPR. It's called Reveal. It's an investigative report for an hour. And I guess Tuesday before last, and then it repeats. Maybe it was Saturday. But they actually give you some idea about this gun trace task force that was really a shakedown of all kinds of people in the black community to rob them, to, you know, harass and intimidate and humiliate and control. And I remember one story very briefly where they chased a brother. He wound up hanging from a fence, and then the police shook the fence, and then he dropped into it was an overpass onto the highway and was killed. So it's quite a story. And 8 police were convicted because they basically, I don't even know the time frame, but it was a whole racketeering scheme, you know, robbing people in the community, setting them up and threatening them as drug dealers and all. So I'm going to hang up because I need to get some rest as I continue to listen. But I really want to hear your coverage of it and bring some people on who have the deep skinny.
Well,
and thank you so much.
The unfortunate thing, thank you so much. The unfortunate thing is that these kinds of stories are quite normal. I hate to use even the word normal, but this has happened before. We did a series when I was the editor of a newspaper about 2 cops in the Bronx and what they would do to get or to make, as they call them, collars, meaning arrests. They had records of being the top cops for arrests, which would indicate that they were very proficient and efficient police officers, but they were gangsters. They topped the list of officers making the most arrests, but essentially they just snatched people up, young boys, young men, and made them guilty of crimes that they never committed. We named the officers. We talked about what they were doing for years. Nothing happened. And New York is not unique. This is happening in Baltimore. You pick any police department in a major city, you would find something like this going on. We don't know what else to do. You expose them, and nothing happens. Absolutely nothing happens. So I think we have to really get back into this business. It's a risky business. People disappear. People are shot and killed by police because they're running their own crime syndicate within the police department. And they have the blessing of their supervisors and the executives, because, of course, everybody gets a taste of the illegal activities. So police corruption takes many forms, and it's alive and well, especially in communities of color, because people don't think that they would fight back. They don't have the wherewithal to hire lawyers, and even if they do, these things are likely to go on for a long time, so people can't sustain an investigation, and they eventually give up. And it is calculated that that is exactly what they would do. But it's still worth doing these kinds of stories, because we need to know. The Central Park case was a classic example. A woman, a white woman, is sexually assaulted and beaten within an inch of her life as she was jogging through Central Park. And the pressure was on, including from Donald Trump, who took out a full-page ad in the New York Times calling for the death penalty and so forth. And miraculously, they came up with these young men and said, yep, here they are. Here are the people who committed this crime. Totally fabricated. They ended up going to jail, serving time, their lives disrupted, and the cops who produced them as the, quote, criminals who committed this crime knew. They just fabricated a crime. The prosecutor had to have known, the judge in the case had to have known, but nobody cared. The main thing was that the city could be satisfied that the police department, being so efficient, in a short time produced the people who committed this heinous crime. Of course, we know that in the end, the city had to settle with them. But that's not the point. The point is that at any time, and we've seen this happen over and over again, not just in New York, but across the country, police departments fabricating stories and fabricating arrests, and then they take it to the next level where the prosecution of these crimes also is false, and they know it, but the idea is that they're producing results. It's an awful trend. It's been going on for decades, and it needs to be further investigated and certainly stopped. Michigan, Leona, you're on the air.
Greetings, you trees.
Hello.
Hi. I was calling today because I caught a little news blurb on my internet thing today. It says New York sues President Trump's charitable foundation, and it's by a Jennifer Peltz from the Associated Press, June 14, 2018. It made me think about your shows with Charles Ortel and his work about the Clinton Foundation. And I was kind of like surprised and, you know, like, oh, interesting. The lawsuit was filed by the New York Attorney General Thursday, and it said that President Donald Trump used his charitable foundation to settle personal business disputes and bolster his political image with donations directed by his staff, et cetera, et cetera. It said that the Donald J. Trump Foundation was little more than a checkbook for payments from Mr. Trump or his businesses to nonprofits, regardless of their purpose or legality. Democratic Attorney General Barbara Underwood said she has sued to dissolve the foundation and seek $2.8 million in restitution. Is there any movement on, you know, in terms of the Clinton Foundation, though, right now, being sued? Forgive me if I'm not all the way up to speed.
The action against Donald Trump, actually, so far as allegation, you know, it's not proven. It is not a settled matter.
Okay.
It is an allegation that the Trump Foundation used the foundation in ways that are not permitted by charity law. Okay. And that is to settle matters having to do with the personal business of the foundation's personnel, meaning Trump and his family and so forth. And that is not at all permitted. So right now it's an allegation, a very serious allegation, but it's not the first time the allegation has been raised. So it means that they are going to be pursuing this, and under charity law, if there's enough evidence to sustain the charge that the charity foundation was used in a way that is not approved under charity law, they just disband the foundation. People are fined, and if it's serious enough, they go to jail. They're charged with crimes. Charity law is a very serious matter, which is why, of course, we have taken such an interest in how the Clintons used the Clinton Foundation. And to date, they have far outstripped any other charity that we know of in terms of raising money and using that money in ways that charity foundations are not permitted to use money. So we're talking here about billions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, maybe hundreds of billions of dollars worldwide. So, the Trump Foundation, I think the charges look prosecutable. But, of course, Trump has already vowed to fight these charges, and he's entitled to do all of that. But so far, we have to bear in mind that these are charges. They're not convictions, and he has the right to defend himself against these charges. I don't know that he would necessarily prevail, because by the time they come up with these charges, it's usually the case that somebody has done a great deal of searching, and they line up expenses and they try to trace down where the money went. Was this a charitable effort? Was this a charitable cause? And if they find, no, it's really a personal matter, paid for with foundation money. You see, the thing here is, charities enjoy protections and privileges under 501c3 and 501c4 sections of charity law. And so they're able, as nonprofits, they're able to do a lot of things and enjoy those privileges on the assumption that they're doing work that the government might do, or they're doing work, you know, on a charity basis. When they break that law, it is a serious matter, because it would then be interpreted that under the false notion that they are doing charity work, they're actually conducting business as usual, but deducting these expenses as a charity is allowed to do, and getting away with it. So this is why they're pursuing Trump. And it's been coming for a long time. You know, he's been under the microscope before, under the previous Attorney General, Eric Schneiderman. And we have this new State Attorney General, and she is proceeding with the investigation. So we'll see how it turns out.
Okay. Okay. All right. Okay. Thank you so much for the explanation. Appreciate it.
Thank you. 888-874-4888. This report coming out today, later today at 3 o'clock, everybody's watching for it, and for different reasons. But our reason is that many of the activities of the Clinton Foundation are wrapped up in the actions that now present themselves as matters having to do with how privileged information and classified information was handled. Because don't forget, the one of the main persons involved in the foundation was also Secretary of State. And the connection here would be how the foundation might have been used in a pay-to-play arrangement where so-called donors enjoyed a lot of cover. You know, they didn't have a lot of accounting to do except as donors. And we know what the connection is. The donors enjoyed unusual access to Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State and many favors allegedly were done for their donations to the Clinton Foundation. So people are watching it for that reason as well. That's one of the reasons we're watching it, to see whether the report gives us any insight into whether the probe was specific enough to make a link between the actions of Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State in soliciting and in obtaining these donations and hiding their real purpose under the idea that these were donations to a foundation. And they were not normal business as we would interpret it, but they were really just the generosity of many high-profile people around the world, even governments around the world, individuals around the world, donating to the Clinton Foundation. And then there's another thing that you have to look for now, and that is, where did the money go? To what purpose was it put? This category of donations, we're talking here about billions of dollars. And it should be said that many international governments are now very keen to know the answer to that question. Where did all this money go? And to what purpose did the money end up improving people's lives? So it's we don't know whether the report would actually spell these things out, but we can't see how it would not be able to make that link, that many of the so-called donations to the Clinton Foundation might in fact have been and were in fact, if they were able to make these connections, for political purposes that were used in turn for purposes other than what the foundation was established to do. You may recall that we said it over and over again, this foundation ostensibly had one major purpose, which was to build a presidential library in Little Rock, Arkansas, to house the papers of Bill Clinton. Well, since then, they basically ran it as they took that as the hub, and then they created all these other things, all these other projects that they were not permitted to do, that were illegally launched. They were illegally formed. But they did bring in a lot of money, and we don't know where the money is. So we'll see. Thanks, Leona, for your call. Jeff from New Jersey, you're on the air.
How you doing, sister?
I'm all right. How's by you?
I'm groovy myself. I'm groovy. I wanted to touch on a couple of things. You know me, I like to ramble on. But as far as the police go and what their behavior is right now, it's that they need to start paying attention and see that they're getting played, because they're going to be put between the public, the haves and the have-nots. Their lives are going to be on the line when the stuff hits the fan, if you know what I mean. So So they really need to pay attention and have some morals about themselves as far as what they do, because they're given their pretty much carte blanche to do whatever they want to do. And that's the bait. You know, they think they're going to have some power, but they're actually going to be sitting in the middle. In the middle of things, you know, they're the guard dog now, but you know, they're going to be the hot dog on the grill in a minute. That's one thing. And as far as you know, Trump people in New York, and I talked about the caller earlier in the week, Jerry. She's from New York. She said she supported Trump, which is kind of odd because most people in New York understood what this man was when he was in New York. Nobody in New York, New Jersey really wanted to vote for him. I think 96% of the people in New York did not vote for Trump. So I think you'd be spied on if you ask me. That's just very, she is very odd and very, very out of place to have her call in. But other than that, I really wanted to say to, you know, to listeners out there that this is a fight, you know, and the government is bigger than we are at this point in time. But we got to treat it like the bully. If you're going to go down, keep swinging. You know, Brother Richard Pryor said we're in the midst of hard times. It's going to be so hard they ain't even going to have a year for it. It's going to be hard times, you know. And being stuck between that rock and a hard place, we've got to find a way to get past the hard place. Because the rock is going to change. The rock is going to move. It's got a different shape. But we can get past the hard, we can get past the hard place and be able to free ourselves. And that hard place would be the structure of things. We got to find a way to get around the structure of things. In the as far as the government apparatus, et cetera, until we can get on the other side and change it. Because if we can change the structure of things, if we can change the hard place, the rock is not going to matter. And the rock is just these, you know, these politicians, Trump and everybody else that's up there stealing what they can steal, the businesses that are doing what they want to do to the public. But we can change the structure, give ourselves a break. And I think that's what really his election is about. It's about giving us an opportunity to gather ourselves. We're going to have to deal with the show, you know. We're going to deal with the show for another year and a half, whatever, 2 years, 2.5 years. We're going to have to deal with the show. But in that time, we really need to organize and create our base, because any structure without a base is not going to stand. You know, we have
but
to get
Jeff,
together with the community. Yes.
In the meantime, I mean, we can't deny the fact of the effectiveness of the daily conditioning that we're getting, that it is useless even to try. We are vanquished, and we have to just get used to it and adjust to it. You're telling us a different story. You're saying, yes, the foes are formidable, and they are quite successful at taking, I mean, they own the narrative right now. So what do you see as a way, if we are to prevail, even with patience and all of that, what do you see as a chance, that as a likelihood, that we absolutely can prevail? We have a good shot at it.
As a bartender, I had an opportunity to talk with a lot of people from a lot of different areas in life. And there are a lot more people who are going along at this point to get along, but they see what the problem is. So they're not really uneducated on the problem. They understand what the problem is. Again, they kind of need some tools to get it together. And we lost the, you know, throwing the liberals and the left threw their hope into the Democratic Party, which was kind of, you know, we were shamed. We led down to a dead end. Now we got to reverse course, and we got to find the right street, you know. And how we can do it is we have to educate the youth. If your school is not providing the proper education, ABCs and 1-2-3s, find a church, find an Elks organization, find a Masonic temple, and teach on Saturday and Sunday. You know, that's how you're going to get over. Share this, you know, you share this information that we have. You share these radio programs that you're doing. That's how you're going to get it. It's going to take some time. But until then, you know, I take attitudes like this. If I die and go to heaven, the good Lord is going to ask, he's not going to ask me whether I want to lose. He's going to ask me, what side was I on? Was I on the right side or the wrong side? So I got to be on the right side. And you got to keep fighting that way. How do you face your children if you give up? What are you telling them to do? You know, so in any circumstances, whether they can't do a math problem, whether they can't, you know, they need to work on their baseball game or whatever. If you're not out there, keep trying and keep fighting for them. What are you telling them? So it's not a matter of if we want to, if we're not, it's we have to. You know, we have to get down and get dirty. We have to get back. We got a little lazy for a time coming out of, the 70s into the 80s. Everything was good. However, we're back at that time again where we got to take to the street. We've got to do things like protest. Even if you do the smallest thing where you don't spend money somewhere, you don't have to be on the front line. You don't have to be on the – if you don't spend money somewhere, like in New York and Staten Island where Eric Garner was choked to death, don't spend any money there. Don't spend any money in Ferguson. You know what I mean? If you can donate money, donate to the good reverend up in was it Hinton Harbor in Michigan.
Oh, Reverend Pinckney.
Right, right. If you can do that, you know, if you can then support somebody, the littlest thing. Because you're going to find out there's other people out there like you, you know, other people out there like you. And once we understand our numbers, we can get together and do something. And those who are out in the front, if we can give them support, you know, only 10% of the people do the work. If we can show support, show up when they ask us to show up, send money when they ask us to send money. We got hope, because if we don't have hope, we ain't got nothing, you know. Because if we give up on a situation, we've given up on God, we've given up on ourselves, we've given up on anything. So, you know, and I think that's one of the problems with millennials. They don't have hope because they didn't grow up in church. And they didn't grow up with the spirituality. But that's another thing. But so we have to bring that to them, you know, and let them understand that there's more to fight for than, you know, what goes into your wallet and from your wallet to the table. You know, it's about your pride. It's about your self-respect, you know, and you can have satisfaction in doing menial jobs. You can have satisfaction in doing things that are tedious and don't seem like anything. Our greatest heroes that anybody could ever say that they saw was in their own neighborhood. And they were ordinary people who went to work, who got out there and played with kids, who led the Boy Scouts, who led the Pop Warners, who did all these things. Those are the people who are the real heroes in everybody's life. And all you got to do is do what you're supposed to do. Care for people. Take care of your neighborhood. Take care of your home. Take care of your children. You know, make sure they get an education. Fight for them when it's time to fight for them at the school board. Fight for them when it's time to go down to the police department. And those are the real heroes. Those are the real heroes of everybody's life. So you can do, people can do it, and you can be that. Just do what do what's right. You know, do what's right.
Thank you, Jeff. Thanks for your call today, and thank you for your instruction. Thank you. From Edgewater, E, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Eutrice.
Hello.
Hope everybody's feeling well today.
Thank you.
I have a quote here to read. See if you can guess who said this. If you can convince the lowest white man that he's better than the best colored man, he won't notice your pick in his pocket. Hell, give him someone to look down on, and he'll empty his pockets for you. That's the quote.
I have no idea who said that.
That's Lyndon Baines Johnson himself.
And he said this in reference to what? Or in what context did he say this?
Oh, I'm sorry that I got the quote off the YouTube on one of the videos I was watching, and I can't even recall it, but I just thought it was something of his, something that came out of his crooked mind, and it sort of like sums up what we're in, what we've been in for thousands of years, and the way they keep control. The 10% can control the other 90 by this kind of rhetoric, nonsense, and seems to be working, seems to work very well for them.
Well, could you explain, what is your explanation for why people who say these things are so popular or so influential in our society?
I guess, I don't know, I guess that people are very fearful of things in life, and if they have somebody to take their side or make them feel stronger or protect them somehow from bad people that are going to take everything from, they can convince them of these things, then they feel better and they support these racist people. I don't really know, because I grew up, I was 9 years old. My brother took me to Murray DeK Show, the Four Tops, Martha and the Vandellas. Stevie Wonder was only 16 years old. I mean, Murray DeK brought people together through music. There was a chance in the 60s, because I saw it with my own eyes, and I, even though I was only 8 or 9 years old, we were all getting along. He had half the bands were black and half the bands were white. And you sat there for many hours and enjoyed the music. I mean, the Four Tops, Bernadette, and all these. I was just in awe of the whole thing. It was such a great thing. And I don't know what's happened. What's happened? We've allowed these racist people to destroy our lives. Could it be
that we still had racism back in those days, except we didn't really acknowledge it as that? Because at the end of these concerts, and at the end of people feeling really good being together, whites went back to their segregated neighborhoods, and blacks went back to their segregated neighborhoods. The understanding was that you could tolerate a momentary feeling of integration, but you knew that it wasn't real. You knew inevitably that the reality was that you were not together. You just enjoyed a moment in time, but everybody was clear about how it would end.
But it still was, there was a glimmer of hope there that things were changing for the better, and people were understanding what went on before, and now after Martin Luther King, and we're going to get together and do. And then the Beatles came along and swept all the white people. I mean, 12-year-old kids buying all, it was Beatlemania. And I don't think black people really cared about the Beatles. And it sort of created this other, another wedge that got in between and destroyed everything that was being created to help. It just, and I don't know if it was planned out. I wouldn't doubt it. I mean, I know.
Well, I mean, you look at the history of music and entertainment in general. It really provided a moment of, you know, people to exhale a little bit and ignore and set aside the harsh realities that they actually were living with. And by the way, I must mention that in many cases, the music that we were enjoying, even by these white bands, was music purloined from blacks who could not themselves, they were not permitted to enter the real world of music. And so whites borrowed their music or stole their music and made everybody happy. It's like Elvis Presley. Elvis Presley didn't have a prayer without the musical genius of the blacks that he, quote, borrowed the music from, where they themselves, the originators of the music, had no way of making a living off of their own creativity. So, but in any event, music was one of the ways that people were able to break down the barriers, the strict racial barriers of the apartheid America that we know. But in the end, as I said, after all the good times, people went back to their racially segregated communities. And they knew then that the times that they had in the park, the wonderful music that they enjoyed at the local music hall, it was all momentary. The reality of life was so scripted that everybody understood that the ideals expressed in the music had nothing to do with the realities that they were living.
Well, there was a time in history where there were white slaves. I'm sure there was white slaves at one time. And then they found a way to replace those white slaves with black slaves. And it's just an extension of how they keep control. That's the point I'm trying to bring about. In order for 10% to control 90, they have to keep us divided. So this will go on forever until we're able to look past everything and get back together where I thought we were back in the 60s. I could be wrong, but the British came along and did it again to us. You know, it was the British invasion, and they pulled the white people away from the black music.
That's not how it actually worked out in historical terms. There was a white class that was oppressed. They were called serfs, or they were called servants or something. They were not called slaves. But they certainly did not have many privileges in the societies where they functioned as slaves, in the sense that they were the service providers and they were very, very poor. And it was a generational thing. They never were able to climb out of their rigid and rigidly controlled economic status. This is where we talk about as class. But over the years, we have seen very little exploration of what slavery and serfdom and other forms of economic oppression. We really haven't examined in a way that people could understand it. What was it? How did it get to be? How was it sustained? Why did it last so long? Who did it benefit? Instead, we get tied up, and this is natural because this is one of the ways we are controlled, by being confused with each other. If we were to take these things apart and study them very closely, we would see how much in common we have. A person in Russia under such circumstances would easily identify with a Brazilian in such circumstances, because the intent is the same, the social structures that were erected to support these kinds of exploitations were the same, pretty much, all over the world. But we have a very interesting knack of making things look like they were unique here and they were unique there, and they weren't. They were just made to look like that. Thanks a lot for your call today.
Thank you very much.
Gwen from New York. Gwen from New York, you have a few minutes with us.
Okay. I'll take it. How are you today?
Okay. How are you doing?
Good. It's gorgeous in New York, so I'm feeling much, much better. I'm glad to not have any gloomy clouds, which is why exactly I'm calling, because I want to say that, you know, my husband was 20 years older than me, and my husband was black, and his brother was shot in the back of the head with, you know, by a cop. But I remember Pete saying to me all the time, things were so much better in the 50s and the 60s. He said, people were not like they are today. And I'd say, what are you talking about? They were lynching people. They were, the KKK was running around. And he had this, you know, and he said, but it was just different. The music was different. I said, right, Pete. But I said, it was really, really harsh. And I said, it was, you know, unabashed. But he never gave up on that. He really has this way of looking at things about that period of time. And I think that's just maybe being romantic at a certain age in your life about the realities, because me being 20 years younger, what I saw was I saw a lot of TV from the 60s. It was pretty harsh, people getting hosed and beat up and hurt. And in fact, my husband himself, as I said, saw these things up close and personal. You know, their family was not untouched. They were black and they were very touched by racism. So I can't really go along with this romantic looking back and saying, yes, the music was great. And you're right. We all did know who we were going home with that night. I wasn't there, but I mean, in theory. But I also think that there was, their music was super important in at least asking the questions and opening up a dialogue and taking a peek in, maybe not going all the way in, but taking a peek in. And there was a thrust to try to change things. It didn't feel apathetic. I think that's what made the 60s so important, is that people were taking a stand. And it was very, as you know, if you go out and you protest sometimes, one of the things I love about protesting is at least I don't feel like I'm sitting on my butt that day complaining about it, doing nothing. At least my body's in the street and I give it up there to be used as a tool to try to push things along and make the world we live in better. I think that, you know, everyone is right that we're living in a really tough time right now. No two ways about it. But I also don't like this idea of people throwing their hands up in the air and saying they. There wouldn't be a they without an us. We allow them to do what they do, because when we don't take a stand, and let's face it, we really haven't taken a stand. We're really busy with going out and eating as much food as we can, with our personal lives, personal enrichment. So I don't really think that people have given it their all to try to get in front of these issues, including myself. And I think that, but I do think we have an obligation to do so. I think the previous caller, I'm sorry I didn't get his name. I liked what he said.
Oh, the music is playing. That means I gotta go.
Right.
So I thank you very
much. You gotta go.
Much,
I gotta go. But I just want to leave it there.
Thank you so much for your call. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, and we'll see each other tomorrow, barring major.